Okay, so we're almost done with season 10 of Mention and Dispatches. We got this episode. We got one more. I think we're going to manage to make it through an entire episode in sequence, or an entire season in sequence. It's going to be the first time since like season one that we've pulled this off, but we're going to do it. I have faith that we are going to do this. And tonight we have we've got a returning guest and a new guest. Merle's been here before on Mention and Dispatches, talking connection stuff mainly, right, Merle?
Connections and NSDM, yeah.
Yeah, connections in NSDM. So that is Merle from the National Security Decision Making Game Group that is present at Origins and Gen Con and Dragon Con and pretty much anything else that ends in con. But Merle is also part of the crew that helps plan and run Connections Online, which as we are recording, this is going on right now. And as you are listening to it, you missed it because it was last week. Also joining us, first time here with Mention and Dispatches, Pat Mooney is here from the Nations and Cannons folks, the historical RPG that takes place in the American Revolution, a little before, a little after, but basically that period, the late 18th century. And so Pat is here because they've got a new Kickstarter for Nations and Cannons that is going on right now that is bringing Nations and Cannons into the 5th edition world. But you guys have been around for, a couple of years now, at least 5-6 years, maybe.
I would say probably 4 years. How much of that has been publicly facing? We did our first major print run 2 years ago. That was when we first attended Gen Con, and that's when we started to really actually get the product out, get word out in the street, and build a community kind of piece by piece.
Yeah. I remember seeing the products at game conventions like Origins. I think you were doing them through Indie Press Revolution is mm-hmm. where I remember seeing them, going back a while at least. You know, I mean, it's been a while that I can recall seeing them there. But when you throw a pandemic year in there, like all bets are off, you know, you just sort of lose track of when things actually happened. So that's where I was a little off on the years and trying to figure out, you know, what we were looking at.
Well, the other thing for us is that we're coming out and we're trying to really hone in and do something that hasn't quite been done before. So it has been an evolving process. It's been something of an experiment where there are fits and starts and there are rules that we try to model that we then have to kind of go back to the drawing board a little bit. So now, you know, our first product that we put out was a basic rule set. And this book that we now have up on Kickstarter is our first stab at a full-length campaign guide covering the first half of the Revolutionary War.
So talk to us some that you've mentioned the campaign guide here. So talk to us some a little bit about kind of the history of what was the idea behind Nations and Cannons? Like, why are we doing this? And what was the first thing you got out and kind of how it's evolved a little bit to where we've got to the point where we are now? And then we'll talk some about the Kickstarter here in a few minutes. So,
sure.
So take us back to the beginning. In the beginning, there was light.
In the beginning, I was working on a project for the American Revolution Institute of the Society of the Cincinnati, which, boy, howdy, that is always a mouthful to say. So my day job, I work at a designer and a producer at a company called Playmatics based out of Brooklyn. We do a lot of gamification work, a lot of work with nonprofits, biomed stuff, effectively finding ways to model complex systems into things that are more grokkable and understandable, sometimes for the layman, sometimes for educational perspectives, or to help, you know, you build data toys to unpack things that, you know, have congruencies but might not otherwise be readily apparent unless you have a system that's built to be able to put in front of people. And so for this project, you know, we were tasked with building a not war game about the Revolutionary War, right? Okay. The intent being that, you know, yeah, you're still gonna have battles and you've got a little battle sim and everything, but it's a logistics and a supply game. The intent of it is really to unpack some of the mythologies that have built up over, you know, the course of the centuries on the revolution being inevitable, on you know, the certain level of unity that was between the states, right? Really getting into a lot of the challenges and dilemmas that were faced by the constituent entities in that conflict. So the Continental Army, the Congress, and, you know, the state groupings, and how it was this, you know, long, grueling war of attrition where nobody had any guns or ammo to speak of. You know, you're constantly struggling with hyperinflation, and you're facing down the greatest military on the planet. How do you manage to hold your army together? And the answer is, if you're George Washington, you retreat a lot. You pick your battles. And the, you know, while immersing myself in that project and kind of learning a lot about this period in history, I kind of was struck. You know, my lightning bulb moment was two separate thoughts. One, the idea that Alexander Hamilton absolutely knew the spell Vicious Mockery. And number two, that flintlock firearms could fit pretty well into the existing action economy of 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay.
And so, you know, with that as kind of a starting point, our goal became to think about ways that if we wanted to tell stories historically, you know, looking back in this time frame, how would we do it? What would be all of the things that would be necessary in order to create a system where you take the elves and wizards and you strip them out of D&D and you replace them with, you know, a brown best musket and an artillery piece.
And here we are.
Here we are.
When you started this whole thing, though, with the idea of let's put people in kind of a first-person immersive setting for the American Revolution and sort of the lead up to it, right? Because things don't just start on 1775. Like there's some lead up to this. The idea behind, you know, hey, let's put people in that time period. You guys started out, you weren't fifth edition when you started out. You were building your own rule set early on. How did that, what was the start on that and kind of how did it evolve before you got to the point of, hey, we should do fifth edition?
So it kind of, we had a little bit of strategic thinking where we sat down and we thought, you know, ultimately what is the goal of this project? What is, you know, the through line that we want to hit? And so, you know, as someone whose day job it is to work with lots of grant funded, you know, type of nonprofit stuff, boy, I could tell you the horror stories of clients coming in and, you know, frittering grant money away, of, you know, or having limited resources and making the best educational tool that you can, but being completely hamstrung by mismanagement, right? So at the end of the day, I wanted to make something that was a good consumer facing product, something that was fun, that had a reason to exist, that, you know, differentiated itself from its peers. But I also wanted to find something that would be able to exist in the educational space, that would be have the widest possible appeal. And the thing about school teachers, as I'm sure you're very well aware, right, is they have a million things going on constantly. And for even the most game curious teacher out there, learning a whole new system from scratch is always going to be a hurdle. You're going to get a handful of them, right? Like the sort of the devoted few who will spend their weekends just devouring, you know, some indie zine that they pulled out of their latest convention. But by and large, there is a value in having a system that is an understandable open standard. And that system, you know, for better or for worse, is a 5th edition D&D. It's the juggernaut in the space. And it's one that, you know, a lot of people are familiar with. It's kind of got that baked in appeal. And, you know, now we're kind of at an interesting moment where, you know, the film just came out. And so that's sort of sparking interest all over the place. But particularly, you know, and mostly in the last year or so, schools are really starting to establish D&D clubs that are funded, that have, you know, resources, actual resources from their departments behind them. And so if the ambition is, you know, not just to put out a TTRPG product, but to put out something that is compatible with rules, you know, broadly that folks already know, that we can then get the most buy-in to the most schools as possible. Well, that's really our goal.
Yeah. I've done some occasional professional development talks here locally with some of the middle and high schools on ways in which you can integrate games into classroom stuff. Merle, obviously, NSDM is a educational foundation. It educational nonprofit, is that the?
Yeah, we're 501c3.
Okay. And
purpose.
And for added comedic benefit, the whole idea of you wouldn't believe how much government and grant money gets wasted on things. Merle and I have both worked in the defense business in the government. So we are very, very painfully aware of how easy it is to light money on fire when you're working on these things.
And efficiency is built into any system that needs redundancy. And that's what government's all about.
Yes, yes. We are not quite fluent in bureaucromancy, but we are rather conversant.
No one is. No one understands
the good yourself, Grant.
Look, our boy Jim Ozarski is very proud of his fluency in bureaucromancy. Because that's his day job, and that's what he's been doing for like 20 years. And he is excellent at it, and some of the stories he can tell would really make your hair stand on end. All right, so we're trying to get educational material in front of people to help them learn a bit more about the American Revolution and sort of where these things came from. And as you're developing the story, the historical research kind of wandered off in what direction? And I'm going to let Merle take over with some of the follow-up questions here, but where did you start and where did you start wandering off to as you sort of, you know, went down that historical research track?
So as a historian, and I would call myself an amateur historian because I don't have a history degree, but someone told me quite wisely at Gen Con a couple of years ago when we first started out that once you have a book published in your name that has historical subject matter in it, you can call yourself a historian professionally. So I'm going to cling to that one as my lifeline here. There are kind of two things that I'm always really interested in. One is the kind of the weird different cul-de-sacs in history, the side stories, the strange little avenues. I'll throw out some weird ones for Rev War buffs out there, right? Like, you know, the Republic of Vermont, the concept that the battle that we fought farthest west took place not in Kentucky or Tennessee, but in St. Louis. All types of strange skullduggery going on in New Orleans with the Spanish Empire at the time. There are a million different bizarre and interesting pieces that get left out of the historical record because you can't tell them in a contemporary history, right? You know, there's only so much space, and especially in education, you have to hit the big picture topics. So that's the stuff that I find fascinating, always want to include, because those are, you know, those weird edge cases are a role player's, you know, dream, right? They like to take those edge cases and jump on them and take them to extremes because they allow them to tell really cool stories and differentiate themselves from what might be the norm in, you know, a historical period. But the other one is really, it's trying to establish that this was everyone's revolution. Right. The thing about revolutions in general is you have this kind of interesting oscillation in the power structure where the moment that you declare your independence, you know, from a superior nation, right, all of the rules go out the window. And so you have folks at the time who are floating the concept of all men are created equal. And we know how that turned out, right? But at the time,
about the women,
right? But at the time, you really did have some people who earnestly believed, you know, radical egalitarians, people like Thomas Paine, who got effectively kicked out of America, went over to France during the French Revolution, pissed all of them off because he was too radical, got bounced back, and died effectively in poverty because he was so busy trying to shout from the rooftops about giving everyone, you know, equal treatment and equal rights, that he managed to make really, really powerful enemies out of the exact people that he helped put into power with his quill in the first place. So, you know, more than that,
against Thomas Paine is the reincarnation of Alcibiades. Not because of his whole egalitarian mindset, but because of his stunning ability to piss off every political patron he had in any given direction and get thrown out of virtually every seat of power he was ever in. And for folks that are true history nerds, they will really glom onto the idea that I'm throwing out here of Alcibiades as you know, sort of this, you know, political and socio-military gadfly that keeps getting bounced around ancient Greece, that Thomas Paine really strikes me as sort of a second coming. He's the American Alcibiades. Mm-hmm.
Gadfly is a great word for that type of shit stirrer, we'll say.
Yeah. It applies to me in the wargaming world. So we're good there.
Yeah, his picture's in that next to the in the dictionary.
Yeah, it's me. So, you know, Mo Rocha in the comedy world and me in wargaming.
It's fine. That's it.
Let me just carry that point, you know, kind of to one step further here, which is, you know, there is this popular conception of the Revolutionary War as this stuffy old white man's war, right? You know, as it's a bunch of old dudes in powdered wigs and, you know, while the landed planter class and the bankers, right, you know, North and South, were the two that really came out of the war with any type of benefits and a society that they could kind of mold to their specifications. At the time, people didn't know how the country was gonna shake out. And that's powerful from a role-playing perspective. And it's also, you know, I want to unpack the notion that fully a third of the Continental Army didn't speak English as their primary language, right? You had thousands upon thousands of Black soldiers, indigenous peoples on both sides of the conflict, with immense contributions that often get, you know, if not left out of the history, you know, kind of swept aside as an afterthought. You know, women like Deborah Sampson and Anna Maria Lane, who would fight, you know, disguised, or, you know, others like John Adams's wife, right, who would advocate from the sidelines. Abigail did an amazing job of, you know, consistently trying to hold her husband to task, to remember the ladies and to, you know, include them in the conception of what these United States would be. And so from a certain extent, Nations and Canons it's not revisionist history. Our intent is always to rely on primary sources. But, you know, the biggest research task that we've done, the one that I'm most proud of, is to come up with a cast of key characters that, you know, effectively can serve as pre-made characters that anyone who goes on our website can download and play as. And, you know, you've got your kind of heavy-hitting, folk heroes. Daniel Shays is a particular favorite, one that I definitely wanted to include there. Little fun, little fanciful. But you also have, you know, a variety of women and people of color, and they're all there, you know, in the historical record as these heroic figures. We've taken them, we've pumped them up a little bit, we've made them a little bit larger than life, because at the end of the day, you know, a game that's based on 5e is going to be a story of folk heroes, right? You're not your average soldier. You are a little bit extraordinary, but the whole backdrop of it is based around real historical events, and we're threading you through those stories and giving you the chance to have these high moments of drama that are all, you know, built in and grounded in the events that happened and, you know, the spirit of the moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You mentioned the idea of, you know, the American Revolution being the stuffy old white man's war and the guys in wigs and all that. And I pulled it up quick because I knew where to find it, but it made me think that one of the big misconceptions of the American Revolution, you know, we think of George Washington and Ben Franklin and just assume that all the founding fathers were these guys in their 40s and 50s. And Lafayette was 18 in 1776, right? I'm looking at the list. Aaron Burr was 20. And where'd we go? Nathan Hale was 21. Alexander Hamilton was 21. Madison was 25. Henry Knox was 25. I mean, these weren't old guys, right? These were campus radicals. Right. This is really kind of the age that they were at. Say again, Merle?
The other thing in the period is you had an enlightened class that had a relative level of wealth, and they read a lot. No TV, no cell phone, okay? They read a lot. So there were a lot of people that were steeped in the literature of natural law, the rights of man, and thinking about things in long, profound ways. So a guy who's 20, who's a big geek and reader, is probably equivalent to the kind of people you see in their 30s or 40s, the way we train people today, and that they've had a lot more time to think about this if they had the leisure time and the wealth. And people like Hamilton and Burr were lawyers. They made a lot of money. One Adams was a lawyer. Jefferson, Washington were planners, and that's a good part of why we think of them all as established figures and, generally speaking, much older. Washington and Ben Franklin were the two that were on the upper limits of age, Ben Franklin in particular. But most of these guys were from their 20s to about 35.
Yeah, Nathaniel Greene was up there a little bit, but not too many of the others. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, again, you think of the stuffy old white guys, and that's, yeah, they were still white guys, but, you know, they were all, you know, a bunch of teenagers or not much more than at the start of the war, obviously. And, you know, 8 years later, everybody's grown up a bit. But yeah, at the start of the war, it was a bunch of kids.
And keep in mind, in that period, English was the majority language, but it wasn't the only language. There were lots of areas that spoke German, lots of different immigrant communities that came from one place or another. You know, that was a factor. And the Indian nations were still a big factor in terms of population, because, for example, the Creeks in the southern states could muster 14,000 warriors, according to some of the calculations. They couldn't keep in the field very long, but there's a population there. And a large colony was 75,000 people.
Yeah. Yeah. If you need them to show up for one big fight, you could get a lot of them. If you needed them to show up for a year and a half, maybe not so much. As you're going through some of the historical research and able to pull and show primary sources for, you know, hey, look what we found. What kind, if any, pushback have you gotten versus, you know, pats on the back for, hey, this is great, thanks for digging this up?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Generally, from the consumer level, you know, the types of folks that we're targeting, you know, we made a game with Black Powder Firearms in 5e. Right. And we wanted to make a game that was had a value add that really put a lot of effort into balancing those systems. We didn't just throw them in, you know, half cocked. And I think the material culture that has gone into making Nations and Canons has had a pretty big impact. One of our periphery products is a misfire deck called Black Powder Blunders. And that was all, you know, I have a couple reenactors on my staff. I've started to dip my toes into that world a little bit. And I really wanted to get into it's one of those balancing acts in games where you want to have rules that simulate conditions of the time frame, but you also don't want to get bogged down into, you know, a bunch of tables and, you know, crazy modifiers that just become overly complex and grind the game to a halt. So verisimilitude is what you're aiming for. This misfire deck was really fun because it allowed us to flex our muscles a little bit. You know, when your flintlock jams, you know, you draw a card, and then as a result, you have a bunch of kind of wild or fun effects. Some of them are relatively minor. Some are, you know, much more. You draw a artillery card that you roll poorly on. You better hope that you're not standing next to that cannon when it goes up in two. it's scrap metal and a big ball of fire. It's a way for us to dig into a lot of those like very hyper specific types of actions. You know, my flint shatters and I have to, you know, socket a new flint in there, and maybe I have different flints and they have different properties as a result. Or I have a hang fire, so, you know, I still, the gun hasn't gone off. I don't know when it's going to go off. The GM rolls in secret, so, you know, you still have to kind of keep it pointed somewhere where it's not
going to shoot you. Look down the barrel and see what's going on.
Yeah. And I have the stories I can tell of players who do just that, and then it goes off the next round. I'm like, well, you should have known better. You know, so that's a good example of something where we can have that level of rich layered historical depth, but it's a periphery product, and it's something that it's not essential to the core adjudication of the game, which we've kept, you know, still true to the period, but relatively streamlined. Another one that we're working on, you know, as an accessory for this Kickstarter is we're calling it Poor Richard's Almanac. And that is, you know, it is based on some of the almanacs that Ben Franklin wrote. It's about one half overland travel rules, you know, coaching houses and things like that. Weather specifically, you know, lots of weather rules and rules for things like weather effects that may form, simulating weather systems, even, you know, catastrophic weather systems, which, again, can affect black powder in all kinds of myriad ways. But also just a bunch of just pithy quotes and witticisms that are in there, kind of like into the margins. That's going to be a lot of fun to write, and a good way to bring that 18th century flavor to bear in a way that then becomes a part of the game space.
I'm flashing back to the old first edition AD&D Wilderness Survival Guide.
But some similarities. The other thing is there's so much depth in the American Revolution because you can have source books on the colonies because they're independent states and think of themselves that way. You can have source books on the Western frontier, like you talked about. Vermont was not part of the American Revolution per se at first. It was its own independent republic. And although there were a bunch of volunteers that joined the Continental Army, it was separate. There was a potential for another state called Transylvania. Can you imagine Transylvania in America? Although game players start looking for Dracula. But anyway, you know, there's a tremendous amount of depth there.
Yeah. One of the key things in terms of flavoring the setting and sort of that immersion that you look for the people there is the artwork is great. Like, where did you find the artist? What'd you tell them? How'd you get them to really, you know, turn loose on this? I mean, the artwork is very evocative. It's a great setting to flip through. It does a great job of kind of giving you that period feel. But also, despite having a couple of different artists work on stuff, I mean, it's got a very unified feel to it. How'd you pull that off?
So I cheated a little bit. I have a couple of very talented contributors who did immensely good work, you know, specifically with the character designs, those key characters that I was talking about earlier, that we really wanted to open the book with. Here are all the different peoples that are present in the Revolution, and have, you know, visual examples that are exciting, that are good call outs, that make people amped up and want to play as them. Then we have, you know, a couple peripheral, you know, sketches of different types of black powder weaponry and you know, miscellaneous equipment and stuff. But the vast majority of the artwork, I would say 85% or more, is public domain, right? That's stuff that is from some of it is period, right? Is actually renditions of, you know, great artists of the time or immediately thereafter, painting about the war. And some of it comes from the kind of the golden age of American illustration, right? So these great artists like Howard Pyle and N.C. Wyeth, you know, who really created the visual texture of what we perceive of as the Revolution today, you know, in at the kind of the turn of the century and, you know, the early 20th century, right? A lot of those illustrative books, you know, for that were really used to tell stories. And some of them were, you know, fanciful pirate stories and, you know, like illustrated Charles Dickens and stuff like that. But a substantive number of them were about the Revolution, and they were accurate. These were guys that really knew their stuff. You know, they had reproductions of uniforms of the time, you know, and they spent lots of time going through and poring over the notes. You know, okay, well, a grenadier would have this type of cap, but they wouldn't have these buttons, because there is, you know, substantive, there's a whole sub-discipline within art, on military art, and so we really tried to use that wherever possible, because I mean, not only is it it's an effective and evocative way for us to bring some of those classic images to you, but we know that it's accurate because, in a way, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, right? People that we know have done their homework. What we've done is done a lot of art history research in addition to our historical research, and we are, I believe, the first D&D book with a published glossary of artists in the back, referencing all of our public domain artwork. And that's another part of our educational mission, in that we really want to democratize this work. I have gotten particularly good at, you know, various methodologies for finding scans, high resolution scans of these things. And I really wanted to find a way to make them available because it's a fantastic resource and it is in the public domain. Everyone should have access to it as part of our, you know, our cultural heritage. But it's often dependent on the institution that has access to it, or sometimes, you know, these things are in private hands, they fall by the wayside. And so a lot of that process hasn't been commissioning artists per se, but going down, you know, internet research rabbit holes to specifically seek out versions of those classic paintings and illustrations that are high fidelity enough to print.
Yeah. In fairness, I don't know that most D&D and fantasy artwork has been around long enough to have slipped into the public domain. So I think you are cheating a little bit there with a 250-year head start. So that you do have the advantage of time on your side there.
Well, the other advantage is there are a lot of museums and national parks and groups that actually put a lot of effort into the revolution, particularly during the anniversary, first 100-year anniversary. And artists were using a lot of the themes of the mythology of the revolution to promote Western expansion and the great mission of the United States. So there's a lot of source material out there. It's just spread all over creation. And doing that amount of research is very labor intensive.
And a lot of that art, Merle, from the original centennial was, you know, if you look back at the history, right? Well, what happened in 1865, 1860 to 65 was this great national crisis in the Civil War. And so when the centennial rolls around, you do have this mythologizing, this nation making, where a lot of this art comes about as a way to promote unity and to kind of try to heal the divide.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is a little bit of a mechanical question on the rule set, but I think a little more in terms of scenario design. One of the key things with role-playing games is sort of, you know, assembling the party. You've got your group of folks, whatever complementary skills you manage to pull together. You know, there's always the joke about who the hell wrote the module for The Hobbit, right? You got 14 fighters and a zero-level feat, and nobody packed a cleric, right? You know, it's like, who the hell, whose idea was this? but as you're putting together some of the scenario design for this, you know, one of the challenges that people found throughout the years in terms of, you know, military themed role-playing is role-playing games, you know, ideally exist for small bands of folks to go do stuff. It is your group going off and doing something. And that's really hard to do in a more mainstream military context, because your squad is part of a platoon, is part of a company, is part of a battalion, is part of a regiment, is something, you know, and it would be really hard to make a compelling role-playing game out of, you know, being a line infantry squad in World War II, because there's only so much you're going to run off and go do independently. And that's why even the more modern role-playing games that you saw with things like Merc or Recon or Twilight 2000, you're either, you know, some sort of commando operatives running around out on your own, or in the case of Twilight 2000, the world went to hell and you're on your own. In the American Revolution, I mean, you've got lots of small bands of partisans and such running around, but I imagine it's probably a tougher sell to put the scenario together of these guys all belong to, you know, the 3rd Regiment of the Virginia Infantry or whatever, that you know, you're marching around in formation and lining up to get perforated by British musket balls. And there's only so much you can do with scenario design for that more pitched battle versus the partisans, insurgents, you know, for folks that want to a pop culture touchstone, right? The Patriot movie. If you will.
I see, yeah. Here's the Patriot gets a bad rep among historians, and that is absolutely deserved, by the way, right? Like, it takes a gross number of inaccuracies, and it portrays lots of things in a very different light, well, fictionalized lots of things.
It came out, largely based on Francis Marion, I was living in South Carolina at the time, and one of the National Guard units that shared an armory with our unit traced themselves back to Francis Marion's, you know, light infantry guys. So yeah, it really got hammered pretty badly, yeah, where we were.
But
the mindset, sort of that small unit action, very independent minded. Not that the history is going to be correct and the historians get to go nuts over it, that's fine. But that kind of scenario that the players would find themselves in.
Yeah, exactly. So the reason why it's a good touchstone is because there is that one scene. There are a couple of scenes, but there's particularly the one, you know, right after the British come and burn down you know, Mel Gibson's house. And so he goes out in the woods with his son, and you know, they've got a couple of loaded Kentucky rifles. He's ducking in and out of cover. He's using the petite guerre tactics to rain down hellfire on this you know, hopelessly outmatched little patrol of redcoat regulars. And it's a really good encapsulation, not necessarily of something that was this accurately, you know, 100% historically accurate, but it's trying to hit that fantasy of, you know, the scrappy band of patriots in the woods. And that's really the angle that we're going for here. I mean, exactly to your point, having people line up and just wait for an incoming musket ball that's got their name on it, right? It is, number one, it's very prescriptive. You don't have a lot of agency in that scenario. But also, you know, if we're trying to simulate, you know, a linear warfare where you've got, you know, entire regiments, that becomes a nightmare. That's a war game. That's not a role-playing game, right? The scale is very different. Although we do share some similarities with war games. And so the way that we kind of square the circle here from a meta-textual perspective is, okay, so you are, you're effectively members of a light infantry unit, which are the special operations of the time, right? That are given a lot more latitude than other soldiers would have been. You're also, you know, there's this kind of fantastical, you're members of an espionage and intelligence outfit similar to the Culper Ring. And so this is how we mix and match, right? You've got some players who are soldiers and others who are partisans, who are irregulars, right? Who are, you know, undercover, right? So we've got a mix and match of both, you know, people serving in uniform and others. But you're sent on these missions kind of behind enemy lines or to retrieve sensitive intelligence, to scout out, you know, something, you know, just over that ridge. With the idea being that the missions that you as an adventuring party go on are the ones that just might tip the scales of a larger encounter, right? Of a battle, you know, where you're not the ones single-handedly chasing the British out of Yorktown, but you might be involved, you know, with Alexander Hamilton when he's charging those redoubts. And that's a good example. You know, if you're there with Hamilton, you're having a little of a Forrest Gump moment through history where you're able to pal around with these important historical figures at the moments that, you know, that we really, that they resonate in history. And that's a way that we can portray those different types of characters. We can give, you know, these sort of moments of high drama. But it's really, it all boils down to, you know, giving the party the ability to go out and find those moments in history where we could conceivably, you know, put an adventuring party at the margins and say, go forth and make history. And the way that we do that on a battle, you know, scenario basis is, again, you are a band of scrappy misfits, you know, loaded to the gills. You've got, you know, maybe a brace of pistols strapped across your chest. You are going into battle with way more black powder at your disposal than your standard footman might have. And so you're going up against much larger numbers. They're asymmetric battles where the enemies will generally outnumber you, and a British regular is going to have, you know, benefits if they stand shoulder to shoulder. A sergeant can order them to issue a volley. And if a field officer is around, the field officer can modify the volley and make it more powerful. And so by doing that, you might have 20, 30, 40 different British, you know, enemies on the field at the time, but it all executes relatively cleanly because those abilities are happening en masse. So if all of the, you know, the regulars take their action to either fire a volley or reload, then you can jump from the enemy's turns back to the player's turns, you know, and still play with that notion of scale without it getting bogged down. Like I was saying before, we have effects like cavalry charges, which function the same way. If one cavalry unit charges, then anyone that's you know, within 30 feet can join in on the charge, and they all effectively burn their action to act on that initiative order. Bayonet charges that function in a similar way, etc., etc.
Here comes the 10th season of the Armchair Dragoons podcast, mentioned in dispatches. Let's thank all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. A huge thank you to Stagger Wing, Martok, Patrick Geraghty, Fred and his dog, Mike Quigley, Joseph Knorr, Treb Corey, Robert, Patrick Mullen, Kevin Bertram, Chet Bell, and Hellcat 6 for their support of the Armchair Dragoons and helping us to bring you the best strategy gaming content on the web. You too can sign up as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
The other thing I'd point out is the American Revolution is uniquely suited to this kind of role play, because once you leave the cities on the coast and where the major armies are, which is generally one significant sized army per region, south, central, north, you essentially have all small band organization. And the way things actually worked during the revolution, the British army had a very small circle of control. They did not control the hinterland. In fact, it was so severe that cities like Charleston couldn't get firewood, because whenever the British army sent out foraging battalions, the raiders that he's used in his example are out there shooting the heck out of them, because they're like a swarm of flies. And the further you move west, the more you see things like heroic action. And they haven't really touched on that yet, but when you get into Versailles and George Roger Clark and all the stuff that went on west of the Appalachians, a handful of people, Indians, Brits, Americans, including then Spaniards and some others, can have a huge impact on transfer of territory and on counterfactual and factual history.
So, Merle, there's a question in there somewhere, right?
Well, the real question is, where are you planning to develop? Because what I see right now is you're primarily focused on light infantry. You're focused on essentially the Eastern Seaboard. And the new Kickstarter talks about the war in the north. So it sort of implies you're looking at a war in the south set and maybe a war in the west set.
That's very much the hope. We started this wanting, not wanting to cram everything into one book, because it's too big of a story simply to tell. And so perhaps we're nothing if not ambitious. And so we decided, all right, we're going to come out the gate with our kind of crazy Kickstarter idea, see if that succeeds, but we're not going to compromise it. We're going to do one book, one campaign, which is, the Siege of Boston through to Valley Forge. And then we'll follow that up, once the British enact their Southern strategy, with a second campaign. And that campaign is going to have, it's going to have actions both in the South, right, in and around Charleston, Savannah, Yorktown, of course, but also actions out west. New Orleans, following George Rogers Clark, to the Ohio country, ways that we can talk about kind of the different theaters and the different ways that that those all come together to tell the American story. We've got, I think, a pretty interesting campaign for that one lined up that I'm not quite at liberty to talk about. It's one of those things where we're threading the needle between a number of major historical figures in a way that, we think we can tell like a kind of a grand war epic. Because at that point in time, if the first campaign takes you from level one to level five, right, by then, once you've made it out of the war in the north, you're folk heroes. And so how do we, the campaign in the south, everything is going to get a little bit bigger and cranked up to 11 a little bit, as we try and find ways where players can really put their thumbs on the scales a little bit. I'll give one example, which is, and this is absolutely 100% true, one of the player characters is as a ranger captain named Alan McLean. And Alan McLean was Washington's fixer in a lot of ways, right? He was he led his own mounted company, but he also was something of a man of action. There's an instance where he went out and in plain clothes infiltrated British occupied Philadelphia to gather a bunch of intelligence, which if he had been captured would have been a capital crime. Single-handedly fought off groups of foraging Brits. And the most famous example was when Washington and Rochambeau left Newport and marched south for to converge on Cornwallis's position at Yorktown. He needed somebody to go out to the Caribbean where the French fleet currently was. And I think it's de Gras was the admiral at that time. I always get the French admirals mixed up, but effectively he needed somebody. He put somebody on a boat to go out there to just go round up and say, "Hey, we're going here. You know, we're going to take our land troops down here, and it sure would be nice if we had some naval support so we could have this pincer movement." And the guy that he chose to put on that boat to go out to the Caribbean was Alan McLean, who did not speak a word of French. And this is one of the player characters that we want to kind of, if that is the kind of penultimate adventure before Yorktown of, all right, you know, now you are the ones who are driving the story home. You got to find that French admiral because everything is resting on your shoulders. And how do you get to him? And how do you get to him unimpeded, slip past the British blockade by the Royal Navy and be able to convince him to bring his ships in and get ready for that final confrontation at Yorktown?
Yeah, that you've inadvertently gone where I was planning to go next anyway, which is everything we've talked about so far is on terra firma. Some of the revolution happened at sea. How, if at all, is naval action integrated into all of this?
So this is the number one question that we get. It's a great question, and it's not presently, because we want to do a land-based system. We wanted to get the rules for that right first. The artillery rules that we have probably gone through the ringer the most times, and that we've kind of built to be future-proofed towards things like shore-based batteries firing on ships. We do not, as of this moment, have rules for naval combat, but that's certainly something that we need to address by the time we get to that second book. I've got prototypes. I've got lots of ideas. It's just the type of thing where we want to make sure that we do our due diligence and we have the time to build it, to play test it, get it out there and do it right before we lock that system in.
The other part when you go to naval is you have two components. One is the component of mobility, which has to do with lighters, because the British Navy was designed for operations at sea. So there was a lot of coastal traffic that was still moving stuff back and forth. And there weren't enough British sloops to successfully blockade all the ports because the weather off those ports would prohibit a standing squadron a lot of times. And then there's the whole issue of privateers, which is actually much bigger than the American Navy, because even with the individual states raising some ships, most of it was privately funded as an enterprise to make money. So they would take prizes and then show up in French ports and sell off the ship that they took and all the stuff on it, and then try to exchange it for other material to fight the war or for personal profit. So, a rule set for privateering and for transportation is an important supplement, but it's really hard to simulate because you only have like one John Paul Jones.
Well, and plus the point at which you've now converted your players into privateers, you're playing a very different game.
As an angle for progression, which is also something we've thought about, right, is if you're a player group and you get access to a ship and you want to have systems for progression or lateral progression where you can upgrade the ship, you can, you can get, you can bronze the bottom of it, right, or copper the bottom of it. You can get, more cannons you stick on the thing, give it a better plated hull, smuggling compartments, whatever, what have you, right? How do you square the circle of the revenue that a privateering crew would be receiving versus like your soldiers' wages as it's an order of magnitude greater. But if you're operating as a privateer crew, and if the income that you're getting is based on prizes, and then those, there's an economic system there that allows you to take that those resources and funnel them back into ship upgrades, I think we can make it fit pretty cleanly, where like there is a way not only to integrate, the scale of the types of vessels that you have to the scale of resources that you would be able to afford, but to give you the ability to, go out, take prizes, drag them back to port, and upgrade your guns as a result, and get into that, that classic Sid Meier's pirates fantasy.
Yeah. The other part of it is the way your design seems to have been put together was it's designed for the heroic mythological figures of the Revolution, which is a good reason why some of your focus is clearly on the light infantry, because the ordinary soldier up through even Yorktown generally was way behind on pay, not well fed, not well clothed. It had to be somebody who was getting special treatment or had independent resources. And that really provides a great jumping off point for fantasy and role-playing games, historical and otherwise. But you're dealing with a fringe that's historical, but on the edge. So the thing to keep in mind is you've made the choice between realism and gameplay. For it to be fun to play, you have to give people a certain level of resourcing to get them off the square one.
I think that's a really good point. And what we don't want to do is to ignore those elements, because they are fundamental to not only the war, but to actions after the war, right? The Whiskey Rebellion and Shay's Rebellion, right? All these things happened because these pensioners were unpaid or because their compensation was in worthless continental dollars. So players are, these larger than life figures, but there is an adventure that takes place in Valley Forge. And, while you personally may be, receiving more resources because you're a member of this special unit, your belly may be full, but the standard infantry soldiers isn't. You see half that camp, it has no boots. There's smallpox that's kind of endemic. How does that make you feel, right? And so it's one thing to have a kind of an Oregon Trail simulation, meat grinder where you, the player, is just put through a bunch of horrible scenarios. It's another to be, someone who can think and reflect, especially as a school kid, right? I can tell you, all of the horror stories that went on, during winter encampments in the Continental Army, but it's an entirely different thing to see it, from the eyes of your character and to make them realize and have that moment of, oh, what would I think about this? What would I try and do?
You don't want your player focused there, but you want them to have an awareness of that, because that's how you're going to inculcate them in a real understanding of what went on in the Revolution and how it wasn't one big unified happy family from Virginia to Maine thinking, oh, we're all going to fight together.
Yeah, 100%. So all of our adventures have civics lessons like that are baked into them, that are trying to tell the stories of, what is happening from kind of a political or social angle, alongside the war stories. We do have an educational mission. Anybody listening here, or if you know a history teacher, if you've got someone, in the educational sector in your life, if you go to nationsandcanons.com, there's an educator link that you can click on, and we will send out a copy of our core rules absolutely free. Right, we'll cover shipping. We just want to get it in schools as much as possible. On our website, our quick start guide, which is effectively all of the chapters in that book except for the GM facing stuff, also available for free. It's like a 70+ page download. And our pre-generated characters, because we want to make sure that there are the resources out there, that even if you're a small institution or you don't have a lot behind you as far as funding to put together a D&D club, at the very least, there's a start, and you can use that to tell your own stories, or tell stories set in and around your township, your county, your state. If you don't want to cover the broader campaign that we are designing here, there's endless opportunities to just use some of the mechanics we created to represent local actions. And that's, I think is a really cool way to get kids involved in local history.
Would you like to talk about the adventure hooks that you've got so far? Because you've got sort of pseudo modules and real modules that you're working on. Would you like to sort of go through from an educator standpoint, here's the kinds of things you can expose your students to?
Sure. Yeah. So the there are six modules that we kind of have planned. The first one is the Siege of Boston and Noble Train of Artillery, aka the Knox Expedition. And the design with that one is really getting to the concept of what happened to Boston? You know, after Lexington conquered, there's this massive shift as the city itself became, you know, under siege. You had, you know, tens of thousands of redcoats, 15,000, I think, bottled up there while this army of observation effectively had them in a stalemate for over a year. And that was all militia until Washington assumed command. So it was this groundswelling of popular support while all these local militias turned out. But Washington rolls up one day when he's, you know, made commander in chief and finds he's got this ragtag group of yokels, and he has to whip them into shape as a functioning army and establish discipline throughout that command. How does that work? Right. So that's kind of the first chapter. We go into other stories on occupied New York and talking about the Great Fire, the martyrdom of Nathan Hale, and, you know, the deployment of the first combat submarine in world history, which is David Bushnell's Turtle. You know, and then we roll into actions in, you know, crossing the Delaware, in upstate New York, with you know, a major one is the what is effectively becomes a civil war between some of the constituent tribes of the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois Confederacy, where, you know, they take up arms against one another because several of those tribes decide to join with the British, and others, you know, are swayed by the patriot argument. And it's this powerful moment that causes, you know, lots of lingering damage, you know, between brothers that, you know, that radically changed the future of the Haudenosaunee nations. Then going into to Saratoga and all the actions around Saratoga, and finally ending at Valley Forge, where we really get to, without making it too, you know, guts and gory, focus on the soldier's misery. And in that moment, that sort of liminal moment where there has been a successful battle won at Saratoga, in no small part due to your actions. But Ben Franklin is still over there in France, trying his best to get King Louis to throw in. And you're there waiting and trying to keep everything together before that news crosses the pond and reinvigorates the American cause.
Fantastic. So the other thing that I had noticed as I went through some of the materials is that, you know, you're really working on trying to include areas that are underrepresented in the history. You've got things you're looking at dealing with wildlife and that has been made extinct in the modern era that happened, was available during the period. You've talked about integrating more people of non-white ancestry and education, non-English education, more gender inclusion, because there were a number of females who were very active in revolutionary affairs that are underrepresented and underreported heroes. So, you know, do you want to hit that point a little bit more and talk about specific things that you've been trying to integrate?
Yeah, I think there's a specific key character that I think is a good example here of like kind of our editorial philosophy. So there's one of the characters, her name is Sally St. Clair, and supposedly, according to a ballad, she was a Cajun woman who openly served on the battlefield because she was having an affair with an officer at the time. Is that actually historically true? I don't know. It possibly, you know, strains credulity a little bit, but there is a source, and it's a really cool story, and it's, I think, evocative of, even if this didn't actually happen, the fact that people sang the song means that they thought it was captivating. They thought there was the kernel of something there that might have happened. And so, you know, if I can use that and I can transition that towards making Sally St. Clair, you know, a Black woman on the battlefield, that as a playable character, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take that as proof positive and allow her, you know, players to tell her story, which I think is really cool. Their Nations and Canons is kind of at its heart, a game about revolutions. And so, you know, while this source book that we're kickstarting right now is focused on the American Revolution, and while we have concepts down the line for following it up with other books like we talked about, really the same rule set can apply to the long 18th century, or even the Age of Revolutions. So it's very, very possible that you could use these rules to tell a story set, you know, during the French Revolution, or during the Latin American Wars of Independence. You know, effectively, when you're creating a game like this, there's not a villain in it as there would be in a typical D&D game, like a mustache twirling lich that has immense power. The villain really is colonialism. And so if we place players, you know, in scenarios where they can give voice to resistance. And in some cases, in some of those stories, you know, like Haiti, for instance, right, there's lots of heroic resistance that is kind of ultimately doomed. There's a lot of bloodshed and a lot of suffering as a result. But, you know, it's a way to tell stories that are uplifting, tragic, but uplifting and cathartic. And that's kind of our hope, is to allow you to, number one, no matter who you are, or no matter, you know, how you identify or what type of character you want to portray in the past, to give you the agency to do so. But number two, to allow you to role play in the past, and if you and your GM and your other players, you know, want to follow this through, to imagine alternate histories, the ways that history could have gone, maybe a more equitable society where, you know, the words "all men are created equal" are held to account, you know, after they are written, in the formation of what would become the United States. You know, I think role-playing in history has to have a historical basis, and you have to be working from established facts and, you know, the canvas of events and societies and cultures. But there's no wrong way to tell stories. And so if you can look back into the past and then use that to kind of change the outcome a little bit, but you're still engaging with the historic past, you're still learning about the past through that process, which is really, really valuable.
Yeah, the thing I find often when we run games, particularly public games, is in our after action sessions, because we run events that run like 100 people and three or four different nation states. And then when we're talking at the end of the game, we're talking about, okay, recognize that these things were historical fact that were based off of, and then people made counterfactual choices, and here's the things that became less and less real. So we try to be very careful saying, okay, this thing that happened in the game is something players generated and was not a historical issue, but here's the things that were the foundation for it, and what components became part of the choice and circumstance that built the game narrative that everybody takes away, because that game narrative and buy-in to it is visceral. And that's what happens in role-playing, no matter what form.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing there that's important is that whenever we present a counterfactual scenario, we also always have, you know, like how it really happened as a section, right? We don't want to, you know, just throw out wild assertions, but we want to say, all right, these are the points where we've deviated a little bit. Here's what actually happens. You can go do your own research and follow that thread if you so choose.
I want to take a shift here off of some of the history and the game design piece and put the business hat back on slightly as we start to wind this down here. Before we dig into some of the details on the Kickstarter, I do want to ask, one of the big headlines for the early part of this year as we were recording this, and we actually led off this season with a discussion around it, is the changes that WotC tried to push around for the open gaming license and the OGL. And that spawned a variety of other similar game licenses. Paizo, as we are recording this, has just released their first draft of the Orc license, and Chaosium's already released their draft of the basic roleplay rules under that Orc license. Free League has now spit out their own license or two for some of their systems. How, if at all, did the OGL changes, proposed or otherwise, end up affecting you guys, and how much of a sort of a legal two-step did you have to do with some of the design work that you were doing as a result of those OGL pieces, if assuming you're at liberty to talk about some of these things?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of sleepless nights when all that first happened.
Most of the industry, so you're not alone.
Yeah. I mean, we'd been making this thing, you know, the core rules has been published, has been out for a couple of years, but the material going into the American crisis has been stuff that we've been compiling for quite some time. right? And so we're way, way too late in the game to switch horses. What I did, you know, and what I thought was really important, the moment that news broke, was to go out and try and spread awareness, spread the word, and kind of help players understand that this crazy alphabet soup of OGLs and SRDs is something that, you know, meaningfully affects them and meaningfully affects the hobby. So I was interviewed by IGN, among others. You know, I'm not the torchbearer here, but you know, I did my best to try and really spread that message. And ultimately, you know, I think that message was successful. Now I'm not going to, we are planning presently on publishing this book, you know, as I said, for 5e. 5e is now in the has been released to Creative Commons, so we don't see an issue with that as it stands. We're going to continue to monitor the situation and keep an eye on it for subsequent products. But we, you know, the thing that I think that is really important here from a game design perspective is that 5e, the importance of 5e is that it is an open standard. You know, there are tons of other systems out there, and they all, you know, have had open standards and open licenses for quite some time. Chaosium, I think, is probably the most successful because it has the largest market share as a secondary product. There are a lot of benefits. And I teach game design at the university level, and this is what I always say to my students, right? Working from something that's already established allows you to create, to take risks that you might not otherwise be able to. You know, if I made my own game set in the War of 1812 and came up with an entirely new rule set just to do it, that is an incredibly niche topic. And I would be creating bespoke rules to be able to, you know, portray that topic. I'm not sure if I would be able to recoup on my investment, frankly, by doing that. And, you know, at the end of the day, we have an educational mission, but we are a business. We are trying to, at the very least, break even with this stuff, right? It's a passion project. You know, the SRD has this very long, you know, 23-year history of people taking it and hacking it apart and making new games out of it. This is where D20 Modern came out of, and Savage Worlds, and all the Star Wars D20 systems, right? And that, I think, is really important for people on the fringes who have cool ideas that want to, you know, want to be able to take a large creative risk, but also, you know, have some sense of being able to make back their investment on that risk, right? And you know, like, I'm not advocating going out and doing a cash grab, you know, just to chase the tail of the dragon of what's popular. But I think the third-party publishing community has been responsible for, quite frankly, you know, running circles around Wizards of the Coast in terms of coming up with really cool, innovative, interesting, cutting-edge ways to push 5e down in unexpected corridors. And that's the stuff that you really want to pay attention to, because, again, those are passion projects. Those are things, people that are making that made whole publishing, you know, initiatives to try and create something cool and something fantastical, are really committed to it in a way that, you know, a large monolith like Hasbro is never going to be.
And that's a really good point in terms of your business strategy, because there are two things that are very appealing with 5e. One is the action economy, because you can use that effectively for flintlocks and early rifles. And that's something that not all game systems accommodate. But the other thing is, there's a huge community of people that are great at telling stories and building narratives, and that have prototypes and samples that are models for you to follow. Piezo was originally the people that did Dungeon Magazine, and they've got a huge following now with Pathfinder. And what the big part of the following is their convention modules and their adventure paths, because that's where the creativity is. And a large corporation like Hasbro, and now with WotC as a sub, has never, ever matched that kind of breadth and depth of creativity that the community as a whole has. So you really are going to tap into a lot that you wouldn't see if your game system was Cortex or Ubiquity or something else.
Yeah. All right. So talk to us a bit about the actual Kickstarter campaign itself. Obviously, wherever we are today is like 10 days old by the time people are listening, but
we're still gonna be live for like a week or so. Yeah.
Yeah. But we've got it launched, funded in like 3 days, I think is when you guys hit the first funding mm-hmm. goal. And now we're into some stretch goals in terms of, look, this ended up on Kickstarter because crowdfunding is just how the market works these days. Nobody saves their pennies until they can just go afford to self fund these things. That doesn't happen anymore. But you guys have a core book and a handful of stretch goals and probably some other things projected as we're rolling forward. So where are we on the Kickstarter campaign in terms of what folks are actually picking up as a part of all of this? And then in the longer run, kind of the delivery plan in terms of when we're expecting these things to get to people's hands.
Sure. Yeah. I will contradict you on one thing there, which is the core rules book. We did self-fund, and we did that. I just saved up a bank account, right, and just dropped a big old series of paychecks on doing a hardcover print run, specifically because this is kind of a wild project, right? And it's something that we wanted to make sure that we could show, hey, we're going to do this right. You know, we have established credentials. We're not going to half-ass this. Look at our material and look for yourself and make your own decision if you think it's worth backing. And I think that that's, you know, played out for us, right? Like I said, you can go on our website and download our quick start. It's all there. And that's material that's been, you know, tested. It's been through the ringer. It's tried and true. Up on the Kickstarter right now, we have, the products that I've been mentioning, this campaign book, The American Crisis, the Misfire deck, the core rules, the Poor Richard's Almanac, which we haven't started writing yet, but I've got so much research. I'm so excited to dig into that one. And then the other thing that we've been doing are we have cloth maps, just period reproductions of largely maps that were done by military surveyors, watercolors, that we found really nice color ones that we had high resolution images, again, going back to their history research, right? Upsampled them, cropped them for print, and we just printed them out on
and those are wonderful. I've got one coming to me in the mail. It's wonderful. Okay. The cloth maps are great. I mean, the accessories that you've built are all building to the theme and appealing to all the kind of little touchy-feely things that gamers want to have. The dice set, the insets, and the multicolored dice, and the pins for iconography so that you can wear it to the convention events. It's great.
Yeah, that stuff's been a lot of fun to put together. And it's great because that's helped us kind of, we have these peripherals that have helped us achieve our core goal, which is really to get this book out. Brant, like you were saying, like our next steps is we really want to make inroads into the educational community. You know, we've been out here, we've put the work in to get the rule set into a place where we now think is good enough to bring into classrooms. And we, we're going to be attending lots of different conventions, not just, consumer conventions, but the National Social Studies Convention this year is going to be in, I think, Nashville, Tennessee. And so we're going to be rolling up with a module that is taken, custom module we're going to be building, taken from the moment when Daniel Boone's daughters were kidnapped by, I think, members of the Cherokee and a couple of other hostile nations at that time. And coming up with a way that we can model the frontier and all of the weird and often fascinating politics that goes into those settler communities where different groups of people are coming together and talk about that moment and ultimately what happened there. I think it's a good example of things that we can make bespoke modules and adventure stories that speak to specific things in local communities. We'd love the opportunity to partner with districts especially to heritage organizations or museums and historic sites to get this out there and bring it to the world so that it starts to make an impact in the educational sector.
Yeah. So once the Kickstarter's done, not just the campaign, but assuming we get past delivery before the next thing, what's the next thing on the drawing board for the larger product line within this whole within this whole process. You talked about a couple of things you want to get to, right? The Southern campaign, this potential naval thing with, you know, chasing French admirals around the Caribbean and probably hanging out with the locals and some rum as well. But what's the next thing we're going to see once the Kickstarter's done? If you guys have you know, drawn out the plan that far.
We've got two things that are also in the pipeline, right? One, and this is probably going to continue to require a bunch of testing, but we may do an open playtest period, is at some point we want to build our own rule set, right? Whether that's a fork of 5e or 5.5, 1D&D, however that shakes out, you know, I got to wait and see how the licensing comes together. But ultimately, yeah, the idea being that, like, you can play Nations and Canons as a fully fledged game that is 5e compatible, but you don't need the player's handbook. It is its own system. And I think that is going to make it, you know, again, an attractive proposition to independent entities and schools where there's not this conflation of what our stuff is and what Wizards of the Coast stuff is. And we can do lots of cool things, you know, ways to inject flavor from like the colonial era, the Age of Enlightenment into that book and create really cool different character options. The other thing that we just started, and this is a wild deviation from all of the history that I have just spent an hour talking about, but one of our stretch goals on the Kickstarter was for a project, a print and play module that we wanted to throw together called Benjamin Franklin Banshee Slayer. And this is our attempt, you know, because people at the consumer level, like folks who play D&D, who use our rule set, a lot of times it's folks who just want a robust, balanced, well-considered black powder system that they just drop into their existing fantasy game. And so if we can facilitate flintlock fantasy, that's a whole other market that we think is really cool. And you know, what we're trying to do there is like lean into, you know, some of those creepy crawlies and things that go bump in the night. But if you marry that to like, oh, Ben Franklin's over in France and, you know, he's still trying to get this this diplomatic mission through and to get the king to acquiesce. But also, you know, he has to go deal with supernatural entities that are, you know, manipulating and pulling the strings at the court, right? There's ways that we can have things that are, you know, ridiculous and fantastical and a little campy, you know, in the way that the D&D kind of often is in the most fun sense, but also lean into the history and real moments in the history. And so, you know, that's a separate product. I think, you know, never the twain shall meet between the fantastical world and our historical Nations and Canons, you know, products. But it is an option if you're the type of game master who, you know, wants to go down that type of pastiche fantasy road.
Well, you can build that as two different compatible product lines, mm-hmm. but maintain the historical accuracy for the people that are into that and the fantasy accuracy, so to speak, for those that want to do
exactly
new and different. The key thing is that you generally would have to have each product stand alone within those pillars, stovepipes of structure.
Yeah, and we never really want to cross-pollinate them. We don't want to get into the
don't
space
cross
where...
the streams.
yes
pretty much, yeah. Or you get struck by lightning, according to Ben Franklin's doctrine.
No, we want to make sure that when someone is purchasing a Nations and Canons product for its historical value, that we're not, you know, pulling the wool over their eyes and suddenly you've got magic and stuff. That it's, it, you know, we do have a dedicated historical product line and that is our primary mission. But if we can establish a secondary product line that allows us to also have, you know, have that stuff, then we can kind of advocate you need it too.
Yeah, look, we're never going to make fun of people for trying to make an extra buck and stay in business, as long as you're not screwing over your customers to do that. You guys are simply, you know, if you can pick up, you know, 30% more money for 10% more effort, why not? Like that's a sensible business decision, and you're never going to hear us make fun of that. You know, that sounds like a good call. So, what should we have asked you if we'd known what to ask you?
I think we did a pretty good job covering everything. The website for the Kickstarter, this is a fun one. We got a special URL. I mean, you can go on our website and do a redirect, but you can also access it from www.yourdadwilllovethis.com. And yeah, like you said, it is going to be running until, I believe, the 9th.
22 more days. So by the time this comes out, it'll be up for about another 10 days.
And we've got the Kickstarter and the home website, you know, both linked to this episode. So folks are going to be able to see that. Plus a couple of the other things we mentioned here on the call. So we've got those links. Folks can, you know, hit the episode page and just follow right through from there, you know, gallop.
We also have a Discord server that we're trying to promote, particularly we're trying to promote among educators, right? To, you know, find a space where you can talk with other folks about using nations and canons in your school environment. So I'll
pass have the link. A number on of very nice videos on a YouTube channel for Flag Bearer Games.
Yes, we you know, that's a project we're applying for different funding in a couple of different places. But we, for a while there, we were doing these type of on this day videos, right? Short, you know, 10, 15, 20 second fun facts about different moments in the war, in the history of the war. And I would love at some point is just, you know, be able to do a whole timeline of them. And again, that's the places where you can dive into those weird side stories that I was talking about. Like you cover all the major beats, but also like there's endless opportunities to just surface really cool and interesting and weird facts about the war. And so if this Kickstarter, you know, succeeds and it doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon, we might pick that back up again and try to go towards even more long form content on there.
Well, that'd be cool to see. All right. So thank you, Mr. Pat, for joining us here on a Tuesday evening and talking to us a bunch about what is clearly a deep and personal passion project for you with Nations and Canons. And for the audience, you know, look, this is an area of the role-playing world that tends to not be that well covered. A lot of the sort of flintlock Age of Muskets kind of stuff, we all know it pretty well from the wargaming world because that's what we do a lot of, but in a role-playing realm, particularly one without magic built in, this isn't a common thing to see. And so this is kind of neat with the historical research that they put behind it. So thank you for coming and sharing a lot of info about that. And again, audience, like the info is down below on this episode. So go hit the episode, you know, go after you've listened to the episode, go hit the links, go check out the Kickstarter, go check out the website and see what it is that you really dig about this. And if you want to throw some support behind it, I'm sure they'd appreciate it. Merle, I know we've got you up past your bedtime. I do appreciate you being here this late, particularly since, you know, we've still got Connections Online stuff to do tomorrow. So.
Well, I was thrilled to be invited because I'm already a fan. I subscribed to the Kickstarter and I ordered some materials already because we're working on American Revolution game for 25, 30 people at conventions is something unique too. But these guys have got a lot of work that they put in and it's high quality stuff. And I can't say enough nice things about it. And since I'm not with the Armchair Dragoons, I can endorse it.
Yes, you certainly can. So we've seen Nations of Canon stuff for sale at the IPR booth. Are you going to be at any of these conventions this summer? Are we going to see Pat at Origins, at Gen Con, at any of the other conventions floating around later this summer?
Yes, we have two that we're targeting presently, which is Gen Con and PAX Unplugged. Those are the ones that are kind of within our ability to get to. Origins, we're still thinking about. We may have boots on the ground there. We may go through a third-party distributor, but we definitely are interested in getting stuff out there. And then, small local stuff. You know, I'm New Jersey-based, so any type of tri-state area Historicon and other things like that, I try and float into at least one of those every month or two, so you might see me around.
Origins has become kind of the anchor convention for the Dragoons over the years because we've got some existing relationships with Gamma and we've got some folks already local to the area, plus I can do Origins pretty cheap also, and we run the wargaming program at Origins and Origins is local to Merle, so NSDM always has a big presence there as well.
So if you wanted to get in the Origins War College to do a presentation on the American Revolution, I know how that schedule's controlled and have a way to add you to the schedule.
You know, if we're talking insider baseball now, that might be enough to tip the scales and convince me to commit. So
between Gordon and I, we're pretty much running that schedule, and I know where the vacancies are because we don't have full programs for all days. So like,
and part of that is our fault because the Dragoons normally provide 6 to 8 hours worth of programming for the Origins War College. And this year we've only got 3 hours available.
So. Yeah. And we've got other competing events. Like Matt's going to be there one day.
Yeah. For the War College, we're losing some of the folks that would normally be there talking from the professional wargaming context, because the main Connections US conference, which is the big in-person one, they get several hundred people, is the same week as Origins this year. So a bunch of the folks that would otherwise be at the War College will be off.
But we got some new people too. I've got a NASA ambassador from Ohio coming to talk about stuff. I've got a Civil War roundtable group for the first time coming to talk about stuff. So we've got some new content types that we haven't had.
You're getting ahead of us, Merle. The Origins preview show is next week.
Okay. So if you want me to come in with Gordon, or better just send Gordon to talk about the schedule, that'd be great.
I'm going to have Gary on the show. He's going to fill the space. We're good.
I see how it is. Okay. Yeah, okay. I see how it is, Brian.
Aardwolf talks for a living, man. It's tough to get him to shut down.
It's bad enough you're calling me out when I hit their Discord server. I mean, I see how it is. You realize, you know, you come back for BGF, I'm going to have a talk with you in the back room.
So yeah, the Buckeye Game Fest, again, Columbus-based. Merle's based in Columbus. It's easy for me to do. So we've got a presence at Buckeye Game Fest. Origins has become our big anchor convention. In terms of NSDM, because they're a large and well-known organization with several decades behind them, they'll show up at Gen Con and Dragon Con and a bunch of the other bigger shows. The Dragoons, we've got our own convention coming up in October down here in North Carolina that we're going to be doing. It's going to be a pretty small thing because we're taking over half a game store is basically what we're doing for a long weekend. But we also have supported what used to be MACE has now become Mythic Con. That's generally around Veterans Day weekend each year. And who knows what other conventions we may show up at. Southern Front we might be a part of. I don't think we're going to make WBC or Historicon this year, but there's some other smaller ones that we may drop in and parachute into and see. So if you want an in-person audience with the Nations and Cannons guys, right now it's Gen Con and PAX. Otherwise, or PAX East. I'm sorry, PAX Unplugged.
Unplugged, yeah, in Philly.
Yeah, PAX Unplugged. But if you're, you know, if you're looking for Dragoons, if you're looking for NSDM, you're going to find us at a couple of other places as well. So, audience, thank you very much for joining us. Pat, thank you. Merle, appreciate you, you know, jumping in at the last minute here when we had to call an audible on this one. And so we've got one episode left in this season for Mention and Dispatches. As I noted, it is our Origins preview. We're going to power down over the summer because we've got a bunch of convention stuff to deal with. And then we'll ramp the podcast back up again in the fall once, you know, the kids are back in the school and we've got our evenings free again. But in the meantime, audience, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on the season finale for Mission and Dispatch.